When we think about scientific research, there's this expectation of total sterility.
Oh, absolutely. You picture a clean room.
Exactly. You
Yeah.
isolate the variables, you run your experiment, and the data comes out like perfectly pristine.
Right. It's a highly controlled, really comforting environment. You follow the formula perfectly, and the assumption is you get the exact same result every single time.
But then you take a trained scientist and drop them into the world of cutthroat entrepreneurship, and suddenly that clean room is on fire.
Yeah.
I mean, you are looking at a business landscape that isn't sterile at all. It is absolute chaos.
You're completely swapping the predictable conditions of a lab for the noise and, well, the massive friction of the open market.
Which brings us to today. We have an incredible stack of source material for you for this deep dive, centered around a really fascinating essay on a woman named Tu Long, whose real name is Yang Ying.
Her background is just wild.
It really is. We're talking about a Tsinghua biology grad who then goes on to do a neuroscience PhD in Pittsburgh, literally decoding brain cognition for a U.S. military project.
I mean, that alone is a highly distinguished career path.
Right.
Yeah.
But she doesn't stop there. She returns to China and builds four different highly profitable companies in a world that the source material describes as being full of accountants, driving Ferraris, and
And influencers showing up with their gangster bosses.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the mission for our deep dive today is to extract her actual operating system. Because this isn't a generic, motivational how to get rich biography.
No, not all.
We want to understand how she takes that rigorous scientific model of a researcher, drops it into this totally unpredictable, muddy market environment, and actually wins.
Because in a business culture obsessed with overnight success, it's very easy to look at her and assume she just possesses some magical Midas touch,
Right.
right? But true value isn't magic. What's actually valuable here is a repeatable framework. She's built a data-driven machine that noticeably raises her odds of success, honestly, no matter what industry she steps into.
But before we can understand how she succeeds, we actually have to shatter this illusion that she succeeds at absolutely everything.
That's a huge point.
The essay we're looking at explicitly calls the idea that she makes money at everything just mere packaging. I mean, for one, her company's numbers are self-reported.
Yeah, you always have to take that with a grain of salt.
For sure. But more revealing than her numbers are her actual admitted failures.
Because looking at what completely failed is the only way to isolate her true competitive edge.
Right. So take her early ventures. She opens a bookstore. It explodes. Within 2 years, it becomes the third largest channel for CEDIC.
Which is one of China's most massive state-owned publishers.
Exactly. Her store is moving volume right behind giant e-commerce platforms like JD and Dang Dang, which are basically the Amazons of China. But at the exact same time, to the exact same audience of nearly 2 million followers, she launches a jewelry line. And it sold exactly zero.
Wait, literally zero.
Nothing. A total flop.
See, the discrepancy there is the crucial data point. Why did the books fly off the shelves while the jewelry just sat there untouched?
Right. Why?
It comes down to how she positioned the product. She succeeded with books because she didn't just sell the physical object. She explained the mechanism of how to apply the knowledge inside them to your real life.
The source has this brilliant comparison. It says, selling books is like selling an eyeshadow palette.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, you don't just want to know what colors are in the box or, if the shipping was fast. You need someone to show you, here is how to actually apply this, and here is the exact aesthetic it will create on your face.
She provided that missing layer of translation.
Every single day, she would take a dense, heavy book like Henry Kissinger's On China and map its historical passages directly to real-time current events.
Right, or she'd take Bob Iger's book on Disney and use it to decode modern corporate strategies.
Exactly. But with the jewelry, she couldn't offer that same layer of intellectual translation. She was just offering an aesthetic object.
Okay, let's unpack this with a different analogy. It's like a world-renowned chef trying to sell you car tires.
Oh, I like that.
You trust their taste in food implicitly, right? But you have zero reason to trust their knowledge of rubber.
Right.
So just because she had 2 million followers who admired her intellect didn't mean they trusted her aesthetic taste in jewelry. They probably thought they could pick out a better necklace themselves.
This dismantles a huge myth for anyone building an audience, honestly. Traffic is not universal purchasing power.
Not at all. The equation she uses is incredibly strict. She says conversion is roughly equal to traffic, multiplied by trust, multiplied by product persona fit.
So if you drop even one of those variables,
the entire system completely collapses. Users only open their wallets in categories where you hold absolute cognitive authority.
But cognitive authority doesn't just appear out of thin air, you know? You don't just wake up and have millions of people trust your intellect.
No, you have to earn it.
Right. So where is she getting the raw insights to build that trust? It all starts with how she gathers her data. She actively bypasses the neat little academic sand tables and goes straight into the messy reality.
And there's a highly illustrative story from the sources that perfectly highlights this mechanism. It takes place during the 2016 U.S. election.
Yes, this is fascinating. And just to set the stage for you listening, we're looking at this strictly as a data-gathering exercise. We aren't taking any political sides here, just analyzing her methodology.
Exactly. It's a pure case study and observation.
Right. So at the time, she was living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is a very deep blue, reliably Democratic area. But she noticed an anomaly in her day-to-day life.
What does she see?
The Democratic ground game seemed to be retreating back into the city centers to knock on local doors, rather than expanding outward into the suburbs and rural areas. At the same time, because her lab was running that military project, she was required to drive to Washington, D.C. once a month.
And instead of just taking the main highways back and forth, she deliberately wound her way through the rural country roads.
Right.
As a scientist, she wasn't looking at this ideologically. She was looking at it purely as an anomaly in the data.
Initially, she was just trying to find some good home-cooked food from the local rural grandmas and grandpas, honestly.
But as she drove, she saw Trump signs planted all over these small, quiet villages.
And she didn't just observe the signs. She started actively recording the data. She began stopping in these small, local taverns and struck up conversations.
Just talking to people on the ground.
Yeah. She talked to roughly 50 older folks in these rural areas over her trips, and out of all of them, she remembered only one single person saying they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Wow.
She repeated the sampling on later drives, moving through different villages along that D.C. to Pittsburgh corridor, and the results stayed totally consistent.
Now here's where it gets really interesting.
Well, wait, I got to push back on this first. 50 rural grandmas at a tavern. That is terrible science.
Oh, absolutely.
It's the definition of a convenience sample. It's not a randomized, peer-reviewed poll by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
At that time in 2016, the entire country was relying on massive, highly sophisticated data models, like Nate Silver's 538, which cited incredibly high win probabilities for Clinton.
Right.
So isn't it profoundly dangerous to trust a tiny anecdotal gut check over massive aggregated data sets?
What's fascinating here is that it would be dangerous if the lesson was just your gut beats the data. But that is a complete misreading of her strategy.
Okay, so what's the actual lesson?
The source brings in Nassim Taleb's book, The Black Swan, to explain this, specifically the concept that history doesn't crawl, it jumps.
Ah, I love that quote.
The true takeaway here is about structural change. When the world is undergoing a massive foundational shift, old models that were built on past relationships become instantly obsolete.
Because the underlying physics of the market had changed.
Precisely. The old polling data wasn't necessarily calculated wrong based on past elections, but treating historical data as eternally valid in a shifting landscape is a fatal error.
So when the tectonic plates of a society or a consumer market are shifting, those models must be completely recalibrated.
Right, against new firsthand frontline signals. She didn't trust her gut. She trusted the raw, unpolished data she was pulling straight from the friction of the real world, you know? She prioritized current reality over historical modeling.
And that willingness to abandon comfortable, established models in favor of on-the-ground reality dictated her biggest career leaps. It is exactly how she approached her decision to leave academia and return to China.
A move that carried massive professional risk, by the way.
Oh, huge risk. She was doing incredibly well in the U.S. system. She had just landed a notoriously difficult NIH grant, which is essentially the holy grail of secure, prestigious funding in American biological research. The wind was completely at her back.
But she turned her rigorous data gathering toward her own life trajectory.
Yes. She decided to survey the Chinese professors at Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon, and the surrounding universities to calculate the actual ceiling for her career.
And the results were incredibly bleak.
So bleak. Out of all of them, only three had department tenure, one was a dean, and exactly zero were university presidents.
She discovered a hard structural ceiling, and beyond just the demographics, she identified a fundamental deadlock in how academic institutions evaluate success.
Her analogy for academic evaluation is brutal. but it perfectly illustrates the problem.
What did she compare it to?
She realized academia demands immediate impact, meaning your research has to be highly useful right now. But it simultaneously demands total originality. Like, absolutely no one in the world's ever thought of it before.
That's a tough combo.
She compared it to demanding that a blind date be a virgin, and D, also tall, rich, and handsome.
Oh my God.
Right? It's an impossible, contradictory set of expectations that prevents rapid scaling.
So recognizing that structural impossibility, she utilized a concept from finance known as real options thinking.
Real options thinking.
Okay, what's that?
When you are making a massive, life-altering leap, you don't blindly obsess over the potential upside. You calculate the exit strategy.
Okay.
You focus entirely on surviving the downside. You want to buy the right, but not the obligation, to make a choice.
Which makes sense, because returning to China was a highly reversible decision. If she went back, launched a business, and completely failed, her downside was fully protected. She still held a prestigious U.S. PhD.
Exactly. She could always pivot back into a lab or a corporate research job.
But if she stayed in the U.S. for another decade, the window to ever establish herself as a dominant force in China's rapidly growing market would permanently close. So she takes a leap.
And once she arrives, she deploys a strategic framework she calls the dimensional strike.
The core principle of the dimensional strike is so fascinating to me. You compete where the talent is heavily concentrated in order to learn, but you make your money where the talent is scarce.
Right. So she goes to Tsinghua University, arguably the most competitive, rigorous academic environment in China, strictly to learn the core principles of biology and data science.
But when it's time to build a business, she doesn't try to out-science the absolute best scientists in the world.
No. She takes her data analysis, her algorithms, and her deep biology knowledge, and she drops them into high-margin consumer industries full of people who, as she bluntly puts it, haven't read that many books.
Which is why she went into skincare.
Exactly.
So it's like bringing a supercomputer to an abacus competition. You don't actually have to be the smartest person on the planet. You just have to be incredibly scarce in your specific operating environment.
Right.
But hold on. If an industry is a talent valley where very few smart, innovative people are operating, couldn't that just mean it's a genuinely terrible industry? Maybe it's buried in regulation, the margins are awful, or consumer interest is just dying?
I'm glad you brought that up, because you're hitting on a vital caveat. The source is very clear that a talent valley is only a gold mine if four specific conditions are met simultaneously.
Okay, what are they?
First, there must be real, enduring demand. People actually want the thing. Second, there has to be an existing profit, how money is already flowing through the system.
Makes sense.
Third, there must be a capability mismatch, meaning the current players are using outdated tools and aren't equipped to solve evolving consumer problems.
And the fourth?
Fourth, there has to be actual physical room to improve the product or service. If you miss even one of those four conditions, that valley isn't a gold mine. It's just a pit.
Wow. Okay, so finding the right talent valley is just the setup. Mm-hmm. Dropping your supercomputer into the abacus competition gives you an edge.
Yeah.
How do you actually operate day to day? Because it is clearly not just about grinding blindly.
No, she applies this surgical forensic approach to every metric, a methodology she calls persistence with a dashboard.
Long-termism is a buzzword that gets thrown around constantly, often serving as a convenient excuse for founders to stubbornly stick to a failing plan.
Right, but her view is completely different.
There is a fantastic example in the sources regarding her e-commerce store. She had one particular cheap product line. On an average day, the back-end data showed 26 people adding the product to their digital cart, but only 4 people actually checking out and completing the payment.
Now, a standard founder would just yell at their marketing team to push harder, you know, run more ads, get more top-of-funnel traffic.
But a scientist doesn't just push harder against a failing experiment. She told her operations team, "This is your failure. Go study the other 22.
I love that. She demanded a diagnosis. And she didn't just want guesses. Her team had to actually unpack the mechanism of failure.
Right. So how do you study the 22 who abandoned their carts? You deploy heat mapping software to track where their mouse lingered on the screen.
You A/B test the checkout page. Maybe the font size for the ingredients list is unreadable on mobile devices.
Exactly. You analyze the exact drop-off points. Did they leave the moment the shipping cost was calculated? Was there a micro delay in the payment processor loading?
She believes 80% of the work is diagnosing the data. You hold the long-term direction steady, but every single day you are running granular micro-experiments and watching the gauges on your dashboard shift.
And this forensic microscopic approach to data totally dictates how she handles her pricing models too. Yeah. She fundamentally breaks pricing down into three separate distinct points.
Right, the raw cost of manufacturing, the final retail price, and what she calls the felt worth.
Felt worth.
Yeah, which is what the consumer psychologically perceives the value to be.
She uses a very simple example to illustrate this psychological gap.
Mm-hmm.
A can of cola might cost a dime to manufacture in a factory. If they sell it to you for $2.50 at a grocery store, you feel like that's a cheap, reasonable price.
Sure.
But if a hotel minibar sells it to you for $6, you feel completely ripped off.
Totally.
The actual space between that 10-cent raw cost and the $2.50 retail price is where the entire concept of a business exists.
And the real art of business, she argues, is artificially jacking up that felt worth in the customer's mind. She casually dismantles the entire luxury industry to prove this point.
Oh, this part is great.
Take a Chanel bag that retails for $10,000. For someone making a normal salary, they might have to save for months to afford it. So the brand anchors the consumer with carefully chosen words like heritage, versatile, or iconic.
They attach specific celebrities to the campaigns.
Exactly. They are synthetically raising the number in your head to make the $10,000 feel justified.
And she readily admits she does the exact same thing with her skincare lines. She anchors her topical products by comparing them directly to injectable collagen, a medical procedure which costs thousands of dollars a shot.
Or she leans heavily into complex terminology about next-generation synthetic biology.
Right. She is explicitly using narrative to raise the psychological anchor of her product's worth far above its manufacturing cost. Now, wait, what does this all mean? In The Source, she argues that price wars, where companies just race to the bottom to offer the absolute cheapest product, laid straight to low wages, deflation, and worsening wealth distribution.
Right.
But I have to push back. Aren't low prices actually a great thing for consumers if they come from genuine technological efficiency and better supply chains? Isn't it only destructive if it's predatory undercutting by a monopoly?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the author of the essay points out that exact nuance, specifically warning against treating her view on pricing as absolute gospel here.
Okay, good.
Low prices generated by real innovation absolutely benefit society at large. Layering a compelling narrative on top of a product that has genuine, verifiable efficacy is just smart business. It ensures the company has the margins to survive.
But there is an ethical boundary, right?
Yes. If you use those psychological anchors and fancy biological terms to prop up a weak, useless product purely on narrative, you cross the line into exploiting information asymmetry.
Right. You are no longer marketing. You're just tricking people.
Exactly.
So this deeply analytical, almost clinical approach to business extends to the messiest, most unpredictable variable of all. Human nature.
Yeah, and interpersonal friction.
How she handles friction, interpersonal conflict, and public perception is wild. She actually borrows data from the dating site OkCupid, featured in a book called Dataclism.
The data they gathered on human attraction is incredibly counterintuitive to how most people think about mass appeal.
It really is.
Yeah.
The OkCupid data showed that the women who get pursued the fastest and most aggressively by high-income men on the platform are not the ones who everyone universally rates as a solid, safe 7 out of 10.
No, not at all.
The ones who get the most action are the ones with highly polarized ratings, meaning one group of users rates them a perfect 10 and another group rates them an absolute 1. The middling 7s, the ones everyone thinks are just fine or nice, actually get entirely ignored.
And she maps this exact polarization directly onto her brand building. Her philosophy is that having 70 to 80% of people absolutely love you and 10 to 20% of people actively hate you is the ideal state for a company.
But how does she actually execute that?
Well, she might use extremely clinical pseudo-medical jargon in her skincare ads.
Okay.
A casual bargain-hunting buyer sees that, rolls their eyes, calls it pretentious, and leaves a negative comment rating the brand a 1.
Right.
But her target demographic, a high-earning professional obsessed with optimization, reads that exact same ad and thinks, finally, a brand that takes the science seriously. They rate it a 10 and become a fanatical customer.
The hate actually gives the brand energy. They argue about it in the comment sections. Because indifference is a death sentence.
Exactly. Indifference is death. And this ties into how she defines emotional intelligence, or EQ, completely differently than the corporate standard.
Right, it isn't about being smooth or beating around the bush. She argues that beating around the bush is actually a form of contempt for the other person's intelligence.
Her version of EQ is about genuine cross-class translation.
It's the ability to step completely outside of your own lived experience, to understand the raw, unfiltered motivations of someone totally different from you. There's this story where she got extorted by a professional hater.
Oh, the caliper guy.
Yes. This guy took a vernier caliper, a precision measuring tool, to her product's packaging, found a more 0.1 millimeter discrepancy in the sizing, and demanded 1,000 yuan to not report her to the authorities for false advertising.
And instead of getting furiously angry or feeling victimized, she actually respected him.
Yeah. She said the guy's really diligent. He earned that money.
Her ability to detach and read the motivations of others is even more pronounced in how she handles venture capitalists.
Her companies never took VC money, and they are all highly profitable. But she knows the data. Domestic VCs rarely back female founders.
Right.
So every single holiday season, she sends beautiful gifts and greeting cards to the specific investors who passed on her early on in her career.
Except she attaches her latest highly profitable company financials to the holiday card.
It's incredible. With a note that basically says, here is exactly what you would have made if you had invested. It's like she views human friction as just another data set to optimize. The investor spreadsheet is brutal but genius.
Very brutal.
It's like, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, here's an audited spreadsheet of the millions you just lost out on. She is literally manufacturing FOMO for her next inevitable venture.
But we have to look at the strict prerequisites for this polarizing approach to work.
Good point.
You can only embrace haters and be this aggressively confrontational if your core product is undeniably mathematically good. And crucially, it only works if you are not operating in a highly trust-sensitive industry.
Like healthcare or finance.
Exactly. If you're building software for hospitals or managing retirement funds, negative controversy will instantly destroy you. Her real superpower isn't just being provocative. It's her ability to step out of her own perspective so completely that she can understand exactly what drives a basement live streamer, an extortionist with a caliper, or a cynical VC.
So extracting this entire operating system, we started with this image of the clean room of science versus the noise and friction of the open market.
And her system successfully bridges the two. She takes the pristine, rigorous model of a researcher forming the hypothesis, collecting the data, building the dashboard.
Right.
She carries that framework onto the open market. She lets it interact with the raw, unpredictable human nature of consumers. And then crucially, she brings that messy, real-world data back into her models to iterate and improve. It is a continuous closed loop of observation and execution.
And to actually apply this to your own life, you know, you have to actively break out of your intellectual bubble.
Well, absolutely.
We all suffer from the disease of surrounding ourselves with people who already agree with us. We read books by professors whose worldviews perfectly match our own, but you have to go find the 50 grannies in a tavern in your own industry.
You have to actively seek out raw, uncomfortable data from people you might not even like or fully understand.
Because if you only stay in the clean room, you will never survive the structural shifts of the real world.
You'll just be left behind with the perfect but obsolete model.
Exactly. So we want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over today, building on that idea from Taleb that history jumps, it doesn't crawl.
Old data is constantly expiring.
Right. So ask yourself, What is the 538 model in your own life right now? What established, comfortable truth or piece of historical data are you relying on that might actually be blinding you to a massive structural change happening right outside your door?